This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, the story of the nation's worst naval disaster, the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. The cruiser was sunk by the Japanese on July 30, 1945. There were 1,196 men on board. 900 sailors went into the water, but just 317 survived, as it was days before the Navy found the survivors. Listeners, I invite your questions about the disaster for Doug Stanton. He's our guest this afternoon. He's the author of a new book about the Indy. Its title, In Harm's Way, The Sinking of the USS Indianapolis and the Extraordinary Story of Its Survivors. The book takes readers from the last mission of the ship through its sinking, the rescue of survivors, and the court-martial of the ship's captain, Charles McVeigh. He was the first and only captain to be court-martialed for the loss of his ship as a result of an act of war. Survivors of the torpedoing of the Indianapolis have mounted a campaign to exonerate him, and their efforts have met with some success. You can join us with a telephone call this afternoon. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Doug Stanton is a contributing editor for the magazine Men's Journal. He has also worked as an editor for Esquire and Outside. Doug Stanton, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Celeste. I'm glad to be here.
When did you first learn about the sinking of this ship?
When I was working with Men's Journal magazine in July of 99, I went to Indianapolis to a reunion of the survivors, thinking that I would write a piece about them today as gentlemen in their 70s, and Dr. Haynes, for instance, one of the people in the book in his 80s. But quickly I learned that beneath the surface of these gentlemen who reminded me, say, of my own grandfathers or uncles who were in the Pacific, there were some still very, very deep feelings about this experience, about what it was like to be, what it was like to struggle to stay alive in the water for 5 days after this historic ship is sunk. And I was slowly but surely drawn into this whole story. I remember being up in the hotel room with Mike Carrilla, who's a Chicago area survivor, and his wife Lorraine, and I just asked Mike how he got off the ship after it was torpedoed, and he began to tell me one of the most harrowing stories I'd ever heard. He's 19, and the ship is really rolling over on top of him. He essentially blacks out and does see his life flash before his eyes, but he somehow manages to get back to the surface, and then his ordeal begins. But he was crying when he finished this story. One moment we were talking about, you know, everyday things, and the next thing I know, he's crying, and I'm on the verge of tears myself, and it's just hard not to be moved by what it is these fellows have to say.
Yeah. How have their stories affected you?
That's in lots of ways. I'm in my office right now, and I have a box, and I mean a box of mail, and I don't mean emails. I do have some emails come in from the website for the book, but just a regular box of mails from survivors who have written to say thank you for the book. And I, as a writer, as a reporter, it's not often that you get a story that becomes personal for you, and this one did. And meeting Mike and meeting, say, the other Chicago, Illinois survivors like Gus Kay and Bob McGuigan and Jack Miner, and, you know, Jack, I saw him a couple weeks ago, and he said, not a day goes by that I don't think that things could have been a lot worse, and that is, he survived this whole ordeal. And at my age, I thought, being much younger than them, that there were lessons in their survival that were pertinent to me today, which is they stayed alive by simply believing in their ability to do so. This really is a story about overcoming the insurmountable simply because you believe you can.
Yeah. They had to survive so much, not only the torpedoing and the sinking of the ship, but then there were those days in the water. At the outset, the surface of the water is choked with oil, and it's extremely difficult to deal with. Then there's, after they get past that, there's salt water and sun and sharks. And you write about these guys being able to maybe hear a voice from a mother or also there was sort of a collective sense that we're here in this together and we're going to get through it.
Yeah, it's really interesting because what happened is they heard very simple things. Ed Brown, who's a guy in California, survivor, wonderful gentleman, he's there, and a fellow swims up and says, "I'm out of here, Ed." He says, "Well, what do you mean?" And he says, "I don't. It's easier to die right now than it is to live." And Ed can't believe it. He actually hears or remembers his father saying, "Back in the Dakotas, Ed, you don't quit what you started." And real simple stuff that you learn in grade school, but that's what kept them alive. And I kept trying to figure out what it was about this story that drew me further and further into it, because I had no intention of writing a book when I went down to Indianapolis in 1999. And just recently I realized that thinking of these young fellas, they're 19, 18 years old, out in the water, and everything around them is essentially trying to nudge them into oblivion. And I thought, if that sense of community, that sense of responsibility and duty is what's keeping them alive, had I said anything to my 9-year-old son or any of my friends or my wife, that would keep them alive if they were in a similar circumstance. It was a startling realization for me, but it really seems to be the heart of the book that ultimately what draws these guys back into the world, back into life, are these very simple connections they have on land. Dr. Haynes, who's swimming around, he's one of the principal people in the book, he discovers, in fact, that those that have no families back on land are the first to really succumb to either hallucinations or the drinking of salt water. So that, to me, is really one of the things that's at the heart of the book.
Yeah, and even for this man, Dr. Haynes, who was he had a career long after surviving this ordeal in the Navy, even for him, and he was just this outstanding character. I mean, duty was above all, you know. Mm-hmm. He just worked tirelessly on board before this disaster happened, and in his other postings. But even for him, there was a moment when he apparently told you that he thought it would be easier if he just mm-hmm. was to hang back mm-hmm. and not get involved because things were so bad.
It's true. I'm glad to hear you say those things about Dr. Haynes. He is a wonderful man. He's floating there in the water. Everyone's covered with oil. They can't really distinguish anyone's face. It's a fuel oil from the ship, and it's clogging their ears and their eyes. And I mean, it's a horrible experience. And someone goes, "Is there a doctor here?" You know, just like we see in the movies. And he, as you say, wonders, do I want to get involved in this? What comes next? If I make this commitment, can I see it all the way through? And he does remember his mother telling him that his job was to really minister to people as a doctor. He loved being a doctor. She called him Doc by the age of 8. So his whole life was predicated on this idea that his mission in life was to take care of people, and he used to hold up his hands. And I met him both in Boston and in Florida, where he had two houses. Doug, he'd say, "I had nothing. And the idea that he had no medicines and no bandages pained him deeply. He was not a big guy. He was not... The idea of strength was redefined for me when I was writing this book. But what he did was, his best medicine was his heart and his willpower. And he imparted that sense, as did other people, by the way, that are floating around this group of 400 young boys all clipped together in their life vests, just wondering what is going to happen next. But he's swimming around, at times slapping and hitting them as they threaten to drink salt water. Keeping them alive, so that, in other words, there are people wandering around today who are alive because of these very small, unnoticed acts of heroism.
Mm. And another hero here is Father Conway. Tell us about him.
Father Conway was the chaplain on board the Indianapolis. He had been very friendly with Dr. Haynes. Had helped Dr. Haynes get home, actually, for leave back to Connecticut by loaning him some money, which just brought Dr. Haynes to his knees. He couldn't believe the generosity of the chaplain in doing this. during air raid attacks upon the ship. Dr. Haynes once was, Father Conway was giving a service, and, you know, the planes are incoming, and he finishes the prayer, and then he says, no, go give them hell, boys. I mean, he was both a salty man and a man of the cloth, and he related so well to these young kids. And he himself was not what we might think of as an athlete, but he, too, is swimming around with Dr. Haynes, giving last rites, hearing confessions. This begins on a Monday, essentially, and ends on a Friday. It's this compressed, what I think of almost as like an autoclave, this whole experience, and it's spinning these boys around kind of psychologically and emotionally. And when they're done with this, what's left of them is really who they are. This is a story about meeting a defining moment. And Father Conway is in this, and he exhausts himself and dies from exhaustion. He dies in Dr. Haynes' arms. He's keening in Latin. He's giving his absolution to Dr. Haynes in his hallucinatory bliss almost. And Dr. Haynes watches him die, and then Dr. Haynes begins to bury him at sea as he did over 100 other boys, which was a very debilitating and enervating task. By the end of it, Dr. Haynes has 100 dog tags wrapped around his wrist. He says the Lord's Prayer with every burial. They're burying him, by the way, because he feels it's the right thing to do, but also because they need the life vests of these deceased sailors. To his death, Dr. Haynes couldn't say the Lord's Prayer anymore. In fact, he started to say it when I was interviewing him at one point in his kitchen, and he started to cry once again. He just simply couldn't bear that's how close this event is, even 56 years later. That's what astounded me when you asked how I got involved when I went down in July of 99.
Yeah. And the doctor could never go to church after
he
got out of the Pacific.
He didn't go to church. Although he was certainly a spiritual and introspective man, in fact, he died March 11th, and I went down to his funeral and spoke there in Naples, Florida, shortly after the 11th, and it was a moving experience. I met his children, and they told me some things that I didn't know, that in fact he was still dog paddling in his sleep, even at the age of 88, when he would dream about this event. There is, aside from all this, what seems to be, aside from this tragedy, these guys have a very good sense of humor about it as well. And I'll tell you, Dr. Haynes would take his kids when they were growing up to the lake, to a cottage, and he would bet them if they jumped off the end of the dock, he would get in a contest about who could dog paddle the longest. And they knew what he had gone through as a young man. He's 33. And it was one of his ways of kind of lightheartedly, you know, explain to them why, you know, what had happened to him as a young man. He always won these dog paddling contests, by the way. It was always a joke among them. But they began to handle it in a number of ways, but also these stories remain bottled up.
Hmm. We haven't talked yet about the captain. What kind of a captain was Charles Butler McVeigh, and how did his crew feel about him?
He was a quiet captain. He was a disciplined captain. But most of all, most extraordinary of all, he was also what they called or told me when he was a fair-minded fellow. I mean, captains are either either big or little pains in the neck, and he was neither. For instance, they're serving dinner or supper down in the cruise galley, and he gets a report that it's kind of not such great fare. So he actually goes through the line himself, gets served, tests it out, doesn't like it, agrees with the assessment, and he goes up and says, now listen, these guys work for me. They work just as hard as anybody else, and I want them to eat just like the officers. Now, this doesn't seem like much to us, but on a Navy ship in 1945, it's a kingdom, and the captain is king, and basically he's the one with the voice. And for him to do this, to come down and be part of the crew, when I was there in 1999 in Indianapolis, I mean, this is one of the things they still talked about. So when they're torpedoed, when they're finally rescued by a miracle, basically, and then when he's court-martialed, to a man, they are you know, confused and mystified just exactly why this would happen to him, and have supported since then these exoneration efforts, which today are still bearing fruit.
Hmm. The men were in the water for days. As you mentioned, it was an accident that they were discovered. They were in the water for days before the Navy realized the ship was missing, before a plane spotted them. Why did it take so long for the Navy to miss the ship and its crew?
That's an excellent question. It's one of these, I mean, this is, as you said earlier, the worst disaster at sea. Pearl Harbor begins the war. We know a lot about Pearl Harbor, but even today, we're now finally learning more and more about the Indianapolis, which is the last major ship to be sunk during the whole war. At that time, it moves into the crosshairs of this very strange fate, as if there's a series of cosmic dominoes that are falling the wrong way. One of them, just one of them alone, wouldn't have resulted in the magnitude of this disaster. But when they finally were all compounded, after about three or four of them, it resulted in this massive amount of death. Basically, the captain is denied an escort. They've delivered the components for the atomic bomb little boy to Tinian. They've sailed in this high-speed run from California to Tinian. Turn around and leave Guam for the Philippines. We think that the war will end with an invasion of Japan. If you'd asked them what an atomic bomb was when they were aboard the ship, they wouldn't have told you. So he's not given an escort. Messages are sent ahead to the Philippines that Indianapolis is arriving, and so on and so forth. But unfortunately, these aren't correctly received at the other end. So basically what happens is McVeigh becomes a captain sailing nowhere. He's not expected at any certain time. At the same time, he's not given an intelligence report, which clearly states there are real submarines in this area that are a real threat. Now, this is something called the ultra intelligence, and it's essentially so top secret it doesn't exist. It's not even divulged at McVeigh's court-martial, and it wasn't until the early 90s that the report itself surfaced. So these things, you can see it just keeps getting more and more sense of bad luck here. As the ship is torpedoed, SOS signals are sent out. I didn't know before I started the book, but I do know now that at least two of them are received in the Philippines, but they were ignored because they were thought to be pranks played by the Japanese to draw out ships for possible engagement. So that essentially dooms their fate. And the ship, which was so important to deliver the atomic bomb components, which end up accelerating the end of the war, then completely disappears from the Naval Command radar, and they're left out in the ocean to die.
Mm. You know, you report in the book that, as you just mentioned, there were many hoaxes perpetrated by the Japanese of ships mm-hmm. being attacked so that the resources of the U.S. military would be called into that area. And, you know, for nothing. But it would seem to me that there should have been some kind of standard operating procedure for making some kind of a check on such a report.
You would think so. I mean, the other thing is that within 16 hours of the sinking of the ship, U.S. intelligence did intercept a Japanese transmission which reported the sinking of a large battleship-class ship. Indianapolis was a cruiser, not a battleship, but the idea is that there was intelligence that told us that in this certain area a ship had been torpedoed, but because no one had put two and two together earlier with the SOSs, that too was ignored. This is the backwater of the war. You have to think that everyone is looking forward to the more forward area, preparing for this invasion of Japan. We're well south of Iwo Jima and Okinawa. Those battles have happened. And it's a series of these very micro errors that, taken together, are much larger than they are separately. And when I go through and read the Navy Inspector General report written privately about this affair, basically you see them saying that this total breakdown is caused by an ever-expanding Navy in preparation of the invasion of Japan, and it's staffed with junior officers who aren't quite qualified for these positions. So you have incompetency playing a large role in this disaster.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon. Hello? Is there a caller there? No, there is not a caller there at the moment. Calls are welcome. Questions and comments, join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Doug Stanton is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with him about his book, The Sinking of the Indianapolis, In Harm's Way, The Sinking of the USS Indianapolis and the Extraordinary Story of Its Survivors. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Also, something that played into the proportion of the disaster was the heat out there in the Pacific. So they had the portholes open because it was so miserable, and that accelerated the ships going down.
Right. This is an older ship. This, by the way, is the flagship of the Fifth Fleet. It's a storage ship that's been through some major battles with 10 battle stars. It's an older ship, though. Roosevelt used it as a ship of state in the pre-war era, which means it doesn't have any air conditioning. So on the night of the torpedoing, there are several hundred of these young sailors sleeping topside, curled up in little nooks and crannies and trying to get some cool night breezes. It's really deathly hot down below. This was allowed and not at all frowned upon. The hatches on the ship were open at least one or two decks below. It was in a position called yoke modified, which is a naval term just for these hatches being open. When it's torpedoed, the bow disappears. These men are thrown straight up into the air. Many land back on their feet. Their ears are ringing. They're stunned. They don't know just what has happened. One moment they're asleep. The next minute, you know, this ordeal has begun. The ship sinks in 12 minutes, which is an astoundingly short amount of time. And also, we remember that these SOSs are being sent off, and there's no way to really confirm from a land-based office that this is, in fact, Indianapolis that sent the message. Because by the time they try to do this, the ship is gone.
Yeah.
It's sunk in this deep, deep water. So that when these fellows are in the water, they're looking back and they feel that their home is just totally gone. And they do feel, though, they're due in the Philippines on Tuesday, which is about 36 hours later, that once they're missed and they don't show up, that, of course, planes and ships will come looking for them. We know now, of course, that that never happened.
Yeah. And because the ship went down so quickly, that meant things were rough in terms of launching lifeboats, carrying supplies, and the like.
Yeah, it really is. Writing this and talking with all the survivors that I did, often at their homes around the kitchen table, and recreating it looking at photographs of the ship and saying, well, where were you here, you know, Bob, you know, while I was sleeping here, torpedoes hit here up in the bow, and I ran back here. They're all going to their battle stations because they're not quite sure if it's a kamikaze attack or if they've, you know, collided with a floating mine. And Captain McVeigh himself is asleep in a small cabin called a battle cabin up on the bridge. And when he wakes up and he's knocked to the deck, and when he stands up, he feels the vibrations of the ship, and he thinks it might be a kamikaze attack. It resembles the one that they suffered earlier in March. This is now July. And he stumbles out to the bridge through this white haze of smoke, and he's, I think, just dressed in a towel, and he's barefoot, and he quickly tries to assess what's going on, and for the life of him, he can't quite figure out what has happened. The forward part of the ship has essentially been separated from the after part. There's no communication because of the explosion with this very big ship, which is two football fields long. The engineer down in the engine room, thinking that they may be being pursued, speeds up one of the remaining engines. And now this is a mistake in retrospect because the ship is going faster now, and this broken bow begins to snuffle up seawater by the ton, and it begins to punch backwards after the ship through the bulkheads, trapping those who are down below. And they're desperately trying to scramble up hatchways to get topside and to abandon ship. But the point is that none of this is happening in any kind of orderly fashion because everything is happening so fast.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can try and take another telephone call. We're going to try and go to the toll-free line, a listener on line four. Hello? No, I don't know. You know, I must apologize to the folks that are calling in because apparently we are having some kind of technical difficulty with our telephone system this afternoon. My apologies, because we have a number of folks trying to get in and talk with you, Doug. I'm very sorry to say that we're not connecting with them.
We'll work it out by the end here. It's fine.
Okay. All right. I hope so. Doug Stanton is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with him about the USS Indianapolis. He is the author of In Harm's Way. You mentioned kamikaze attacks.
Mm-hmm.
This was very interesting to me. I had never realized this before. There were also manned torpedoes.
Called Kitans, which were really underwater kamikaze planes, if you can think of it that way, where this is, you know, you asked earlier, why weren't normal systems in place? The Japanese themselves they knew that the war was coming down to its final bitter end, and the Kitan was one of those fruits of that desperation. A man would actually sit inside a long metal tube with an engine on it and the cone of it loaded with warheads and steer himself through the water towards the ship, and of course, when he connected, he would be blown up and killed. It's a suicide mission, and that coupled with the kamikaze attacks, which were just terrifying, and the Indianapolis had lived through these, and I said it, they were kamikaze at Okinawa. They were shelling the island as the Marines themselves stormed it. After this happens, after the kamikaze attack, it hits the stern of the ship and does kill a number of men. It limps back to to California, and this is how we find it then in July of 1945 in the harbor at California, when suddenly the Manhattan Project has come to full bloom, and we've got these components of Little Boy ready to go, and the Naval Command looks around, and there's the Indianapolis. And so it's upon this ship that these things are loaded, and they make this run to Tinian Island, and Paul Tibbets takes off from Tinian and delivers the little boy over Hiroshima. Ironically, it's this very thing that has kept this story, in the way I approach it, in Harm's Way, an untold story. At least this is what the survivors told me after I started working for a while, because I kept saying, if 900 of you are dumped into the water and 317 survive over 5 days, how did you survive? And this is what some of the letters I'm getting are about, is they're just saying, thank you for telling it in this way, because we can think of this as a story of legal drama or as a kind of a military drama involving the atomic bomb. But these fellows are very humble, that's for sure. But talking to them about it in this way has been really rewarding.
Yeah, I think that's the... There are all these other aspects of the story, but I think the story of the men and how they survived is the most compelling in the book. But there are these other interesting stories that are going on at the same time, simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, this is the last ship to really go down in a major way within... I mean, if you go back, they're rescued finally on August 3rd. The Hiroshima bombing happens the 6th. Nagasaki on the 9th, and by the 14th and 15th, Truman has declared victory over Japan. So all within a span of less than 2 weeks, we've had the end of World War II and also this greatest debacle. And America at the time is totally confused and really outraged about how so many people could die so close to the end of the war, so that the New York Times of the day announcing victory over Japan has this gigantic banner headline that says just that, and then down in the lower right-hand corner, there's a very small news item about this cruiser, the Indianapolis, being sunk. They come home, Giles McCoy, Dr. Haynes, Captain McVeigh. No one really wants to listen to their story, and frankly, they're not much interested in telling it. McCoy, one of their principal people in the book, gets home to St. Louis. He's around his mother's kitchen table at lunch, and she says, well, what happened, Gil? He says, you sure you want to hear this? She says, I do. He was very close to his mother, and his sisters were there too, and he begins to tell this tale. And they're sitting there with their jaws open, and he says, okay, I've told it. I'm not going to speak about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And he didn't for over 15 years.
When did these men begin meeting in Indianapolis?
In 1960, just about 15 years after McCoy's told this story in 45, after he's come home, Gil and I have become very close. He is responsible for beginning this whole exoneration effort, for beginning the Survivors Organization, which meets in Indianapolis now every 2 years, to revisit the sinking and to talk about how they might clear McVeigh's name today. He intuitively understood that if he was troubled by memories of this, that he bet that there were other old shipmates that felt the same way. So when he gathers them together in 60, he tracks them down, he has them in the hotel, I guess it would be a conference room today, and he closes the door and he arranges them in a configuration that resembles how they floated in the ocean, to the best of everyone's memory, so that if you and I were surviving this together, we'd be sitting next to each other. And he says, okay, everybody, everything we say here is off the record, it won't leave this room. Let's talk about what happened. And so one guy stands up and he begins to talk, and then another. And he said that they did this for two reunions in a row, and they had to stop it. They're in their 30s now. They have families. They're now not young boys, but they're young men. But if you think back to 1960, this is before the advent of talk radio, before the advent of, say, the psychic hotline, and it's a very smart move on his part to think that talking about this disaster, which was largely ignored by the press and by the public, was an important thing to do.
The torpedoing of the ship was an act of war, so why was the captain court-martialed?
That's a great question. The simple and quick, the first answer is that he was court-martialed because he is the captain. He is ultimately responsible for anything that happens on that ship, even if he's not at fault. This is the way the Navy operated, certainly in this war era, and I think up until the very early 50s, when some of the military codes were rewritten to look more like civilian sense of justice. What happened is, and McVeigh was, I think, confused by the court-martial, but to his credit, one of the odd things of this story, there's something noble about his stoicism in accepting this, because we have a sense here that here's a captain who knows what responsibility and command are. Senator John Warner, just recently I was reading, or I think perhaps watching TV, was talking about this very idea that in relation to the Scott Waddell case in the Greenville, that Waddell is really given, I think, a letter of reprimand, which is a slap on the wrist, even though his career is ended. But Warner is wondering out loud in the press what this is doing. Is this diluting the Navy's sense of a captain's own responsibility, which ultimately is permanent and can't be denied? So they court-martial him because they can, because he wasn't. But technically, they court-martial him because he wasn't zigzagging. And zigzagging is just as it sounds. The ship was not, when it was hit, making these Z's in the water. And they said that he should have been making those Z's because, therefore, he would have been a harder target to hit.
However, when did the Navy give up on that maneuver, zigzagging? They found it to be, after all, not all that effective.
To my knowledge, they still think zigzagging is still considered to be a proper defensive maneuver. But the McVeigh's orders when he left Guam without an escort, without a real full intelligence report, by the way, in that report were four submarines, Japanese submarines, and one of them, the I-58, ended up sinking the ship. His orders also say that he can cease zigzagging at his discretion, and that is at nighttime in times of low visibility. And what I discovered in writing the book, thanks to a fellow named Keith Smith in Indiana, he uncovered in the archives a series of statements taken by the Navy from the survivors from their hospital beds. And when you read through them, you see that the visibility that night was terrible. In fact, it was just the right kind of night to not be zigzagging, but to be making a straight line course because you're doing better time and so on and so forth. However, right around midnight, the moon did break out in some way. this might be the final kind of domino, that the final stroke of bad luck for this ship, so that Hashimoto, the Japanese commander, does see it and he does torpedo it. And there was nothing that McVeigh could have done to really prevent this, because he was operating, he thought, to the fullest of his capacity based on what the Navy had told him about this voyage.
Hmm. And in fact, the Navy called on the commander, Lieutenant Commander Hashimoto, to testify for the prosecution.
Exactly.
And the Navy wound up being embarrassed by this.
Right. Commander Hashimoto comes, and this is a surreal moment in the courtroom. If I know that Gil McCoy was there, so was Dr. Haynes, when this commander who had sunk them is sitting there testifying against McVeigh. And he, as you say, he says, "There's, you know, even if this captain had been zigzagging, I would have sunk the ship anyway. It was just too perfect a setup. It was heading towards me. Now, the Indianapolis would not have been heading directly towards an enemy ship if it had an escort, which would be a destroyer, which would have been circling the ship with sonar gear, and when it spotted the I-58, it would have taken out after it and tried to sink it with its own depth charges." But Hashimoto says this, and it's to no avail. In fact, an American sub-commander, Glenn Donahoe, says the same thing on the stand. But the point is that the ship was sunk, and the Navy's point of view, it's McVeigh's responsibility.
Hmm. Also, for poor Captain McVeigh, he didn't have a key piece of evidence in his defense, and that was the going back to the ultra intelligence on Japanese subs in the area where the ship was headed.
Right, and today, if this were to happen, for instance, the Commander Waddle testimony on the Greenville incident involving the Japanese fishing boat, the Court of Inquiry was available online within days after his depositions. McVeigh's own testimony from Court of Inquiry, to my knowledge, didn't come to light until 1959, and it's still hard to get a hold of today. Hmm. So that if this, you know, you and I would be searching around, and we would be wondering about all the evidence that was made available to him in his trial, you know, had it been complete, and we might find out about this ultra stuff, but he has a lawyer, unfortunately, who is not very experienced, and he has very little time to actually prepare his case. And this very important bit of evidence is never revealed at the court.
Mm. The survivors have defended their captain, and they launched a number of efforts to exonerate him. What kind of success have they seen?
Well, they've had some great success in October of 2000, when our Congress passed a resolution saying, expressing the sense that Captain McVeigh should not be held culpable or thought culpable for the loss of the ship and the loss of so much life. It was a wonderful moment for the survivors, because here the Congress is saying this and it's making this declaration. In reality, it does not repair his record, which may or may not, since this is unprecedented water that we're now charting into, it's never been done. But his record still lists him as having this conviction. What the Navy, however, April 27th, in light of recent publicity given to the whole subject, has agreed to give the crew a unit citation, which they've never asked for in the first place anyway. But further, and most amazingly of all, they've said that they are retrieving the record and looking at it for possible amendment. Now, the survivors don't know exactly what this means, but they're certainly, I mean, it has their full attention, and they're just waiting to see now what the Navy might do with this record. Perhaps it will include putting the congressional resolution as a permanent attachment to the military record itself, so that not only kind of symbolically in public do we hear this resolution, but it's also their part of the record.
How do the survivors feel about the Navy today and the court-martial? Are they angry or bitter with their government?
They're not, and that's one of the refreshing things, whereas some of us who, say, grew up during the Watergate era, the cynicism that pervaded our country after that was carte blanche. This anger is directed really at the Navy, and you know, it's not as if the whole apple crate has been thrown out because of one bad apple. And I found that sense of well, patriotism, really, refreshing among these guys.
The families of the men who did not survive, how have they coped with this this disaster? And what, I mean, we're talking about a huge group of people here, mm-hmm. so I'm asking you to generalize, but
right.
What have been their thoughts about what happened and whether or not the captain was culpable?
It's a great question, and I wondered as I was writing. I just got a phone call yesterday from a fellow named Norm Geckel, and his brother, Ernest Stanley Geckel, went down. He was killed in this ordeal. And he was calling me to see if I had any information, if I'd ever met anybody in my interviews that knew anything about his brother. I mean, there's a sense that life is completely snuffed out and ended tragically by this, and the insult is even greater because of all the human error involved that McVeigh and his crew had nothing to do with. And I had to tell Norm that as of yet I didn't know anything, but he did say that his parents, for years, held this against Captain McVeigh. That is, they needed a place for their grief to go. And it's understandable given the fact that when you go back and read newspaper clippings of the time, you see that McVeigh is testifying on the stand, he's being court-martialed, it happens. So therefore, he's the man who's the whole problem. Norm himself did not hold Captain McVeigh responsible for this. The years have taken the edge off that perception. In Milwaukee, I gave a reading at a bookstore, and an elderly woman was in the audience, and I often ask, these readings are not readings. This book should totally and completely always reflect back onto the story of these men. I feel lucky to have even been able to tell it. So I always say, is there anyone in the audience who's a survivor or related to the ship in some way? And she stood up, and her husband had died in the sinking, and she had a copy of the book. And I said, well, what would you like to say? And she said, the only thing I remember about this ordeal is the knock at the door telling me that Frank perished. And you know, the room kind of went silent, and I realized that since 1945 until now, she had not had any contact really with the ship or other members of the crew. There were survivors in the audience, and they, in the audience itself, they just began talking with each other, and I'm really there just to kind of moderate the questions, because when these gentlemen themselves stand up and begin to tell their story, you know, it's mesmerizing. And there seemed to be some type of, for this woman to come there, she liked being there, and it was positive for her. And if the book can do that, then it's a success, whether or not it's sold a single copy.
Yeah. I can't imagine what it would be like for that woman to sit down and read this book. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. she really probably never knew exactly what happened.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, that's true. And as a writer, to think that you're somehow providing a document, this is a very, very private story in some ways. I get to know many survivors very well, and I think I'm telling a story in an intimate manner about what it's like to have gone through this. But yet, this is a very public story involving court martials and atomic bombs and so on and so forth. It felt like a great responsibility to tell it well, at least, or to try to.
You made the decision to tell it in the story almost of a novel.
Mm-hmm.
How did you make that decision?
I really didn't.
That's just the way it came out, huh?
I would put on, there's this recording by Goretzky called Le Miserere, and there's a track there called Amen, which is a series of choral voices singing what seems to be in a church. I'd heard an NPR interview with a young woman in Bosnia whose parents had been killed, and she said the only thing that kept her alive was listening to this Goretzky music. Now, I just, you know, this is how writers' minds work. I just somehow was drawn, and I said, you know, if that music is that powerful, I need to listen to it. And I listened to it as I wrote this piece. It's chilling music. And I only listened to it for a little bit, and when I was writing the water section, so to speak, when they're fighting to stay alive. Some stories are so symmetrically tragic that all you have to do is tell them and not write them. There's a big difference. And it came in this kind of feverish kind of, spates of composition over about 2 years.
Well, you're a talented storyteller.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Okay, well, great. I really appreciate the chance to talk about these guys.
Yeah. Take care, Doug.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Doug Stanton has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of In Harm's Way, The Sinking of the USS Indianapolis and the Extraordinary Story of Its Survivors. The book is published by Henry Holt.